Welcome back to the Thermo Diet Podcast. I'm your host, Jayden Miller, and I am here with my co-host, Mr. T. Woody. How you doing?
I'm good, Jayden. How are you?
Doing well.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Redwood, our circulation support supplement.
It is also here with the Thermo Diet book. This is, if it's not already launched, it's launching very soon. We got the hard copies into the office. It looks great. It feels great. And the information in it is awesome. So make sure to get your copy whenever you can. And if you're inside of Umzu Fit, you already have access to the digital version. So make sure to check it out there. And our topic of today is minerals. So what exactly are minerals?
Yeah, so in the periodic table, humans are basically made up of probably like 80, 90% carbon. Mm-hmm. Most of us are – carbon is the most neutral element, but we also have a trace amounts of the trace minerals and the macro minerals, macro and micro minerals, of which are all elements that are also found on Earth in large quantities. Human life requires all of these minerals for pretty much everything, for enzyme functions, hormones, fuel, energy production. Literally everything is dependent on hormones, minerals – or minerals. Minerals really run the show, and – so there's macro minerals, which are often called the electrolytes, pretty much, and they all carry a charge. And the micro minerals also carry a charge, but they're not as involved in that. So there's the macro minerals are sodium, potassium, calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, chloride. Am I missing any? And iodine? No, iodine's definitely a trace mineral.
Yeah, I think those are mostly it. And usually whenever people are talking about electrolytes, they're going to talk about the four horsemen. Calcium, potassium, magnesium, and sodium.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. And then you have the trace minerals. So that's going to be things that we need in very small quantities. So something that's less important to consume daily, but very important to consume enough of. So that's going to be copper, iron, boron, iodine, and
Zinc.
There's
probably some more that we're missing, but those are the main ones,
yeah.
I'd say. Especially from like a hormonal production perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been diving a lot into magnesium.
Yes, sir.
Recently. What are some cool things that you've learned about magnesium?
So in general, just as a rule of thumb for the minerals, everyone has a charge. So magnesium and calcium are +2, and iron, I believe, is generally ferrous iron is usually +2. Then you have sodium, potassium, which are +1. If you're deficient in one of the, let's say, sodium, you're going to use more potassium because they carry the same electric charge, so they can be used for a lot of the same functions. And so if you are deficient in magnesium, you're going to end up pulling from your calcium stores. If you're deficient in both, you're going to end up using a lot more iron or heavy metals like lead to do those things. So it's very important to get – minerals are very, very important to get enough of, and probably one of the mainstays of the diet. So magnesium specifically, I like to call the stress mineral because magnesium is bound to ATP. So the more stressed you are, generally the less metabolic or the less energy production you have. So magnesium is essential for energy production is essential to retaining magnesium. So getting enough of the B vitamins, thiamine specifically, B1, it's what they cite. But I think all the B vitamins are important because magnesium is bound to ATP. So the higher ATP production, the more energy producing, the more magnesium you'll retain.
Mm-hmm.
Things like oxidative stress, which is really just inflammation, too much calcium in without enough magnesium, too much iron, too much lead and heavy metals will deplete your magnesium. And that's called your magnesium burn rate. And it's a very interesting conversation, but basically the higher stressed you are and also sweating and activity will decrease or increase the amount of magnesium you're burning and losing.
Mm-hmm.
So magnesium helps everything from muscle contraction, producing
an action potential.
Action potential. There we go. So it's very essential in brain health, muscular health, and not cramping, retaining all the other minerals. And it's really going to be great for sleep and being calm and energetic. I think that's probably one of the biggest things that since phasing magnesium in, which is much more calm and less likely to get amped up.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I like to see it as is kind of like the relaxation mineral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to call it like this anti-stress mineral, the stress mineral, just because it's depleted by stress. And it really helps to counteract stress.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Didn't you say that if you're deficient in magnesium, then a lot of the heavy metals, like aluminum, for example, that has the same charge, I think it was aluminum that you mentioned that has the aluminum same charge.
And lead, usually, I think.
It can kind of take their place and lead to a mm-hmm. buildup of those.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, your body needs to detoxify these heavy metals, and that's just a very interesting, complex topic that I'm not very confident on. But basically, like, so those will substitute for magnesium, and same thing for calcium. So magnesium is an intracellular ion, and calcium is an extracellular ion, and you need to keep those in their places pretty much. Mm-hmm. And what happens is when you get an action potential or excitation, you calcium influxes into the cell, and this isn't a bad thing. Let's be make that clear. But and you need it. But if it stays in there, then it's going to cause calcification, which is basically like, you know, you think of like hardening of the arteries, like the cell, it will clog the mitochondria basically. Mm-hmm. So magnesium and CO2 both help to, well, I guess probably CO2 really helps to get it out. Mm-hmm. But the only way, the more ATP you produce, the more CO2 you produce through glucose respiration, using glucose for fuel, will help to drag the calcium out. Mm-hmm. So if you're deficient in magnesium, you're going to have high intracellular calcium and probably low extracellular calcium.
Mm-hmm. Magnesium is important for mitochondrial respiration too, correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can't – so ATP is bound to magnesium. It's magnesium ATP. So you cannot make enough – or you will be limited by how much ATP you can produce by how much magnesium is in your cell. And it's also interesting, and I've been thinking about this a lot. So I'm reading this book. I think it's called The Magnesium Miracle right now. And she talks about, so one of the main issues in, let's say, aging is calcification. Calcification, fibrosis, and lipofuscin is like the big three. It's the CLF protocol by Matt Blackburn. I'm a proponent of that. I think it's a huge part of our physiology. But so basically, if you take she mentions the experiment, if you take calcium carbonate or some kind of calcium supplement, put it in water, you'll see it makes these big clumps like very quickly. And you put, let's say you put enough in so it doesn't dissolve, mm-hmm. and you keep putting more in. If you put some magnesium in there, it dissolves very readily. So the magnesium dissolves the calcium. So she says that's very important for basically keeping calcium from causing plaque buildup and all that stuff, fibrosis in the heart, lungs, and all that stuff. I'm not, because magnesium is primarily an intracellular ion, I could see definitely you want to keep the calcium outside of the cell, not inside the cell. So I think it's very important to that. I'm not quite sold on that aspect of it, as she was talking about, but I think it's a very interesting thing to consider.
Yeah, definitely. I also feel like it's very important to note that not having enough magnesium in general is also going to decrease hormonal production, like testosterone production, mm-hmm. for example. It's very important for that. There's plenty of studies that show that just simply by correcting a magnesium deficiency, you can boost testosterone production by up to 40% or even more in a lot of cases.
And not even just boost testosterone, just lower cortisol as well.
Right, yeah.
And I think magnesium is an essential part of the steroidogenesis process. I think it binds to cholesterol in the process and helps break it down. And very importantly, and everyone is deficient in vitamin D these days, I think that's largely stems from a magnesium deficiency because you need magnesium to produce vitamin D. Mm-hmm. So I think that's correcting your magnesium deficiency is probably pretty much everyone's magnesium deficient. And things like EMF, like Wi-Fi, they open up your intracellular calcium ions channels, which causes an influx of calcium. So that can deplete magnesium. There's a ton of things that deplete magnesium today. Like I said, it's the stress mineral, the anti-stress mineral, relaxation mineral, as Jayden calls it. So we could probably all use more of it.
Yeah, definitely. Also, on the calcium note, making sure that you have sufficient vitamin D stores and vitamin K stores mm-hmm. or levels is going to help balance out calcium. Also, getting enough calcium in your diet to prevent the increase in parathyroid hormone is going to be huge as well. That's going to help prevent a lot of the buildup. And then I'm sure magnesium plays a very important role in that 100%. Process. I just don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah. So what was the question again exactly?
Whenever parathyroid hormone is high, it's going to leach calcium, which causes a lot of calcium deposits around the body.
Well, that actually probably makes a lot of sense. I'm just thinking of this off the top of my head. But if there's too much calcium in the cell, there's not going to be enough calcium outside the cell. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do? You can take parathyroid hormone to take it, pull it from your bones. Mm-hmm.
That way you have enough outside of the cell. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. And then you get deposition in the scalp, which is one of the main ways that mm-hmm. you get balding. and all that kind of stuff. So making sure that you have low parathyroid hormone, getting enough vitamin D and vitamin K, having sufficient levels of those in your system at least, and getting enough calcium in your diet specifically is going to help prevent that from happening.
And also optimize the energy production. So glucose is going to help not only get calcium out of the cells into the blood where it belongs, but it's also going to help put calcium in the bones where it's our storage hormone. So, or not storage hormone, but so then vitamin D, as you said, very important for absorbing calcium. And vitamin K2 basically is like the calcium conductor, puts it in the right places, not in your arteries and soft tissue where you don't want it.
Right. Yeah. And so basically like that equates to the strong bones that you usually see whenever you're drinking milk.
Yes, sir. And people, the whole idea of consuming less calcium to prevent osteoporosis or kidney stones, that is usually the opposite. It's usually either kidney stones can be caused from calcium oxalates or calcium phosphate crystals. So that could be from too much phosphate, too many oxalates from like green vegetables like chars and cruciferous vegetables, which are very high in oxalates. But as long as you're consuming enough calcium, generally you can mitigate those. You can mitigate the crystallization, as she said, the clumping of it basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then getting enough magnesium helps to even compound that further as far as the benefits.
100%. So you are the salt king.
Yes, I am a huge fan of salt. One book that I would recommend for a little bit more information on this is called The Salt Fix.
I got to read that.
Yeah, so he basically goes through like kind of like evolution and a lot of our ancestors and how they consume salt. He talks a little bit about other minerals, but salt is the main thing. He is missing some context around sugar. So he says that people are demonizing the wrong white crystal. And so he demonizes sugar instead of salt.
Yeah, he hates it.
Yeah. So I don't necessarily think that his perspective on that end is very good, but I do think that he has the salt case figured out.
What is his case against sugar?
He kind of just thinks that it is basically like the low carb approach.
Like it depletes minerals and stuff. Mm-hmm.
That, and then also like inflammation and stuff like that. So I think there's just a lot of context that he's missing there.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is a case for that. So if you're eating too much sugar, you don't have the minerals and vitamins to use it, and it's just sitting in your blood, can cause insulin resistance, but it's a very context dependent. Getting enough sodium will help to keep everything moving in the blood. So there's a couple of studies that have been found, and they're not the best studies, that show like killing your salt intake decreases your blood pressure, increases blood volume, but it's very marginal and it pretty much ends up evening out. It's like very slight, right?
So like whenever you increase your salt intake, your blood pressure will increase just a couple of points and then it'll level off. That's usually because the increase in blood volume, which is naturally going to increase the amount of pressure that you're putting on your arteries and your veins and stuff like that. So whenever you look at blood pressure, you have the diastolic and the systolic blood pressure. Usually the top number, I believe it's the top number that goes up a couple of points whenever you implement a higher salt intake. But it'll only go up like, you know, 2-3 points and then it'll level off.
And that's the same case for pretty much any mineral. That's especially, I mean, they're all water soluble. So getting too much calcium relative to magnesium and sodium will probably do the same thing. Your body is, especially sodium and magnesium, your body is readily capable of, let's say, detoxifying excess or excreting excess. So I think I've read Dr. James Nicotolo, the Salt Fix guy, his book. He talks about how we used to just – salt was our main preservative in addition to sugar. So we used to just get pounds and pounds of salt, and we are very readily capable of excreting salt through both our sweat and our urine. And maybe our feces as well. I'm not sure about that one.
Poop. In feces? Yeah, I think there's a little bit of excretion in that. Typically, it's usually going to be through sweat and urine, though. And, you know, if you're getting too much salt, then, I mean, usually – most likely it's going to come out in sweat. So you're going to get super salty sweat. You might see like some white stains on your clothes, on your workout clothes and stuff like that a little bit more. Not something that you should be worried about. I think hypernatremia is something that is very, very rare compared to hyponatremia, which is low sodium. Low sodium tends to, you have less blood volume. So your circulation, basically like think about it as like you have less volume of blood. So there's less liquid in your blood vessels. And so whenever you have less liquid in your blood vessels, it's almost like making it more viscous. And so it's going to be harder for the blood to actually circulate throughout the entirety of the system. Mm-hmm. That's also one of the reasons that Ray recommends a higher heart rate, is just because the higher the heart rate, the more that you're able to kind of circulate that blood into the deeper tissues inside of the body.
Yeah. And from an insulin resistance perspective, I think that makes a lot of sense too. You don't want stuff just sitting there. You want to keep traffic flowing.
Yeah, definitely. It's also very important, as salt specifically has an antagonistic relationship with adrenaline and aldosterone. So aldosterone, whenever sodium is too low, is going to spike. And whenever aldosterone spikes, you're going to leach all of the other minerals, especially magnesium. And then you kind of run into a lot of the problems that we just talked about with with a magnesium deficiency.
And that comes back to that whole idea of these electric charges. Salt has charge plus one. So I didn't know magnesium. I knew magnesium was a little bit of a big deal, but potassium is huge as well. Mm-hmm. And I think calcium as well. So we have a very good at detoxifying salt. We can get a lot of it out of our body, and we are very bad, not very bad, we're good at retaining salt, but it comes at a huge consequence, which is a survival mechanism, is that we hold on, we get rid of potassium, we get rid of calcium, we get rid of magnesium instead. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy, and salt's probably the mineral to get the most of very easily. It's very, let's say, hypocaloric. You can just salt the hell out of your food or consume salt tablets, versus potassium, magnesium, calcium, much harder to get.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And like, just to reinforce the importance of salt, whenever you, for instance, like if somebody's hooking up an IV to you, it's most likely going to be salt water. Like that's basically what they're pumping into you. So your blood volume increases and you don't, you know, effectively die.
And I mean, that's a great point. Like there's a reason. I mean, humans, I think, evolved from the ocean. And guess what's in the ocean? There's sodium, magnesium, are two of our most popular in cellulons. I'm sure there's calcium and potassium there too, but probably not as much.
Basically what blood is just salt water.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy to think about. But yeah, I mean, that's probably why so many people feel hydrated, to feel great after going in the ocean. I feel like compared to bath water, like you get those wrinkles in your fingers, I forget what it's called, which I think is an evolution adaptation, but I feel like you don't really get those much in the ocean.
Yeah, I wouldn't say as much, or you have to be in the ocean for a much longer period of time before you do get them.
Yeah, and the ocean, if you're not in the ocean a lot, that's a great way to get salt, magnesium, chloride, but taking some salt tablets or just salting your food to taste, just don't avoid salt, pretty much. And honestly, like experimenting, and this is a good rule of thumb for everything, experimenting with a higher intake of something, seeing how you feel, is a great way to do it. I've been experimenting. So I've been doing magnesium bicarbonate, which is a great way to get magnesium. If you need a soda maker to make it, you take magnesium hydroxide, you carbonate it, get magnesium bicarbonate. It's great. I've been doing double dose. I've been doing like 1600 milligrams the last couple of days. Feel pretty good. If the cool thing about sodium and magnesium, so you take too much magnesium, you end up getting diarrhea. Basically means you either need to hold back and do it more slowly, or it means you're getting too much magnesium. So I'm a pretty big dude, so I can probably retain more than a lot of people, but I started with like 400. I tried 1,000 milligrams the first time and I was not having it. So, you can build up to it slowly, like everything else.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. With that, having enough salt is also going to help with your sleep too, because it has that antagonistic relationship or inverse relationship with adrenaline, like we mentioned earlier. A lot of the times whenever people are having trouble falling asleep is because their sympathetic nervous system is in overdrive because those stress hormones are still high. So sugar and salt before bed is going to be very beneficial for your sleep. It's going to help you not only fall asleep, but stay asleep. Because you're going to sustain blood sugar throughout the night. So your blood sugar is not going to bottom out, which is going to cause a rise in cortisol and adrenaline to free up energy stores. So you can get more energy and effectively survive through that fasting period. But then also like the salt is going to help decrease adrenaline as well, which is going to have a positive effect on your sleep.
And that reminds me of a great point. So if you are someone that wakes up in the night to pee, or someone has to pee a lot throughout the day, that is probably, can't say 100%, but very likely from a low sodium intake. So what happens is sodium helps you to retain water as well. Not retained water, but it helps you to like keep a fluid balance. Mm-hmm. I'd say like a, I don't want to say positive fluid balance, but helps keep it in check. If you aren't getting enough sodium, your body's going to excrete a lot more water. So, and that's going to come the consequence of losing potassium, magnesium, possibly calcium. So you're going to pee a lot more. Mm-hmm. Sodium helps to keep you dry, pretty much.
Right. Yeah. I like to think about it as like you're basically redirecting those fluids from the possible blood volume that you could have to urine instead. Mm-hmm. I remember whenever I was pretty hypothyroid, I would wake up and pee in the middle of the night. And then over time, one of the things that I did was increase my salt intake, and I stopped waking up in the middle of the night.
And this isn't saying like if you were, I mean, probably not a great idea to be drinking like a lot before bed, just in general. But if you are, maybe add some extra salt to take a little bit of salt. But it's not like if you are, you wake up once in a while to pee in the middle of the night, oh, you're really deficient in salt. It's like if this is something like you're peeing, I don't know, 6-7 times a day, and then you're waking up once, twice in the middle of the night to pee, there's a, and it's not necessarily the cause, but there's a very good chance you could have beneficial effects by upping your salt intake.
Yeah, 100%. I'd also say from a performance standpoint, like salt is definitely going to be very beneficial for helping to buffer lactic mm-hmm. acid. It's going to be very beneficial for helping with action potential. So sodium and potassium help with basically like sodium is typically on the outside of the cell. Potassium is usually on the inside of the cell. And as those charges switch, sodium will be shipped into the cell, potassium will be shipped out. And then that charge switch is basically what happens down the entire like nerve, so to speak.
Yep.
And so sodium and potassium and magnesium and calcium are extremely important for action potentials. So if you're looking for a way to easily enhance your performance in a very cheap way to enhance your performance, getting in extra salt and then supplementing with a little extra magnesium is going to be very beneficial for increasing your performance very easily.
Yeah, it'll probably help you get a much better pump too, because you're just going to be retaining a lot more water. So you're mm-hmm. going to be able to regulate fluid much better as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I would also say that, you know, whenever it helps with your sleep, it's going to help with your recovery, and then your performance is going to go up because your recovery is getting better too.
Yeah. So on to potassium.
Yes.
Big kicker of the four.
Mm-hmm.
So potassium is extremely important, and again, maintaining that electrical charge for the cell. And hypokalemia and hyperkalemia are both strongly associated with heart issues, specifically in keeping the rhythm of the heart. So you need to keep your potassium stores inside your cell, just like on magnesium, because it helps to keep the rhythm, helps to conduct that electrical charge. If you believe in the membrane hypothesis, which the sodium potassium pump, basically there's a large influx of sodium into the cell when you need to contract like a heartbeat, and a large outflux of potassium, and that's what regulates the cell's ability to conduct electricity. If you do not have enough sodium or potassium, or you have too much potassium, that will completely throw off your ability to produce a muscle contraction, which is going to affect your brain, I mean, nervous system, heart, muscles, everything. And again, as we were talking about, when you'll end up having more sodium inside your cell, which will take it from outside your cell. So it's very important to balance all of them.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. What are some of the best sources of potassium that you'd recommend? Because like that's one that you don't necessarily want to supplement too much with. So like what are some of the best food sources that you'd recommend for that?
Yeah. So milk is great. It's 10% calcium, I think, in a cup of milk, your RDA calcium, and then 8% of potassium.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, again, it's very important to monitor them all, manage them all and balance them all. So it also has some magnesium, I believe, not a ton.
Mm-hmm.
Coconut water, coconut milk, fruits, specifically bananas, mm-hmm. potatoes.
Orange juice.
Orange juice is a great source of potassium, and it has some sodium, I believe, in it as well.
Yes.
Anything else?
No. Coconut water and orange juice, like the adrenal cocktail that people typically do, is definitely one of my go-tos mm-hmm. for potassium.
I'd imagine honey maple syrup have some as well.
Yeah, I think they do. I also know that like baby spinach has a little bit too. So if you're familiar with the vertical diet, he typically recommends a little bit extra baby spinach for the potassium specifically. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that just because like, you know, I don't think spinach itself has that many anti-nutrients in it, but, you know.
Well, it's pretty goitrogenic, isn't it? Or no?
I'm not really sure what the goitrogen content of spinach is. I don't think it's too terrible. It's definitely not like kale. But, you know, I think that the possible detriments are not as good as the benefits for that. Yeah,
I know Adam Bergstrom, who I haven't listened to too much, but he's a huge fan of the baby vegetables.
Really?
He also says they have retinol on them, which I don't know if I believe. Instead of beta carotene, so as they age, they lose the beta carotene, or they gain beta carotene, lose retinol, which is interesting. I don't know how much I buy into that. He's an interesting fellow for sure, though. Do you want to talk about the micro minerals at all?
Yeah. So the trace minerals are going to be the ones that they're very important to intake. You don't necessarily have to like supplement with them, so to speak, unless you're deficient in them. Then that might be a good idea. But getting them in smaller amounts with like specific foods and stuff like that is going to be very important. So like the zinc to copper ratio is very important. I know you're on the copper train right now. You want to talk a little bit about that?
So copper is, as Morley Robinson would say, it is the Morley Robbins would say it is like the foundation of our metabolism. Basically, copper regulates iron. It's also going to be involved in all the mitochondria. It's extremely important. All the cytochrome C oxidase, those are all copper enzymes. It's a lot. It's involved in copper, magnesium are probably the two most important minerals in the body, in my opinion. They're all important to have in balance, but copper, magnesium are probably the ones we're missing the most of.
Yeah. You know, and the more that I think about a lot of this stuff, the more that I think that it's kind of dangerous to say that, you know, X is the most important or Y is the most important, because like they're all necessary. You need them all.
And it's contextually dependent.
Yeah, definitely. So from a contextual standpoint, definitely like magnesium and copper are probably the ones that people are,
on average, people are probably the most deficient in.
Deficient in, yes, correct.
So the only way you're getting copper in is through whole food vitamin C, not just like plain ascorbic acid that does not have. So whole food vitamin C has the tyrosinase enzyme, which contains two copper enzymes. So orange juice, a lot of the fruits are going to be great for getting copper in. Copper is also necessary to make ceruloplasmin, which is the body's, one of the body's main antioxidant systems. And so if you are anemic, copper regulates iron. So basically through the ferrooxidase enzyme, and I think it's like the transferritin enzyme, it's been a while since I looked this up, or that copper basically helps to get iron out of the cell and back into the bloodstream. So most people that are anemic aren't iron deficient. Iron is literally in every food you've ever eaten, or if it's not naturally in there, they fortified it with iron. So you are probably copper deficient, which is getting an iron overloaded. So the iron's stuck in your cells and it's not in the blood where it needs to be. So consuming enough copper, Morley just released a copper supplement, which I don't necessarily think is the best way to get it. But beef liver has about 20 times as much copper as it does iron, I believe. And it also contains large amounts of vitamin A, which you need both of those. A, to consume, make the steroid hormones, which is great for testosterone, progesterone, all that fun stuff. But also to make ceruloplasmin, which regulates iron, antioxidant, all that fun stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I think that copper is definitely something that's becoming more and more paid attention to in the bioenergetic sphere of people. And I do think that it's important. It's also very important to pay attention to the zinc to copper ratio. I think it's like a 12 to 1 or a 15 to 1 zinc to copper ratio. So if you do ever supplement with it, make sure to balance it out with zinc. It's naturally that way in things like beef liver. Also, oysters are going to be a great source of that as well.
We forgot to talk about selenium we didn't mention before.
Oh, yeah. Selenium is another one that we could talk about.
Yeah. Selenium is probably the key characteristic in both vitamin E and glutathione, which are two of the body's most potent antioxidant enzymes on top of ceruloplasmin. Not high levels of selenium, but maintaining enough selenium is going to be extremely beneficial and important for mitigating excess oxidative stress.
Yeah, it's also really important for the deiodinase enzyme. So that's so that's the enzyme that's going to cleave off one of the iodines to turn T4 into T3. So for those of you who don't know, the thyroid hormone is going to be a tyrosine molecule attached to four iodine molecules. I believe it's tyrosine. And then like whenever it comes into contact with the deiodinase enzyme, it's going to cleave off one of those iodine molecules and turn it into the more active form of thyroid, which is T3. T4 can't actually be used that well in like the process to make steroid hormones and stuff like that. So cleaving off that iodine enzyme and turning it into T3 is going to be very important.
Which mainly happens in the liver, which happens to be the best source of copper and vitamin A. So you need a lot of that. And it also happens in fat cells a little bit, I believe. So T3 is going to be really increase your glucose uptake and really going to increase your metabolism. So how much T3 is probably going to be directly correlated to your metabolic rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like a lot of this stuff also happens at a much smaller scale in the peripheral tissues as well. Mm-hmm. So most of it happens in the liver though.
Yeah, and that's also where steroidogenesis, production of steroid hormones, is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But also a really interesting point that you said, I don't know if you're correct in the tyrosine molecule.
I'm pretty sure it's tyrosine. It's definitely not taurine. I'm pretty sure it's tyrosine.
Interesting though that like the tyrosinase has copper in it. So I wonder if that's connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely could be for sure.
And so when we're talking about thyroid and T3 and T4, you can't not talk about iodine.
Yes. So
iodine is found primarily in seafood, shellfish are a great source of it, and potatoes are a good source of it. Mm-hmm. So trying to consume enough of those daily.
When it comes to potatoes specifically, the skin is what's going to have the densest amount of
interesting.
Iodine.
Mm-hmm. And so iodine fluoride are basically opposites. All of the halogens are basically going to be a little bit antagonistic to iodine. Iodine is going to be the biggest, so it's going to be the most stable. And it actually can act like an antioxidant because of that. It helps to – it's like – to draw these electrons, what is it, the free radicals. So it's not going to be a direct antioxidant, but can help to, let's say, quell oxidative stress or slow oxidative stress, mm-hmm. but it's also necessary to produce thyroid hormone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, right, you have the tyrosine molecule, and then you have the four iodine molecules that will attach to it, or the three. It's also, I believe, like that's one of the things that milk lacks that makes it not the perfect food is you lack sufficient, I want to say B12 and iodine are the only two things. Like you could survive purely off of milk if it had those two things in it.
I thought it did have some iodine in it, maybe not enough.
I don't think it has enough.
Okay. Yeah. I also was reading before, I think because of the soil, I was listening to this before, that milk no longer has enough copper in it.
Hmm.
But that's going to be very contextually dependent. So if you can get a regeneratively farmed, high-quality milk that's been from the same family for hundreds of years, then it's probably going to be close to a perfect food. Most of us are not able to get that stuff, so you might have to get some extra copper from oysters or whole food vitamin C or a whole food vitamin C supplement.
Mm-hmm.
And then that brings me to fluoride.
Yes. Fluoride, chlorine.
Chlorine and bromine.
Bromine.
Those are going to be antagonistic, so they're all halogens. Basically, they have that minus one charge, basically. Mm-hmm. So remember, mineral balancing, all the charges, they will substitute for one another. Fluoride, we get way too much in our diet for a lot of people because it's in the water supply.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why they tell you not to swallow your toothpaste.
Mm-hmm.
Fluoride is the most reactive element in the body. Iron is number two, reactive like when it has its charge. Fluoride is going to – it's a neurotoxin, and they consider in India a neurotoxin because it's so reactive. It can cause oxidative stress, but what it's going to do really is it's going to attack everything in its path, and it can displace minerals from your body, so it's going to steal minerals more or less mm-hmm. from your body.
Especially iodine.
Yes, especially iodine.
So it'll decrease the amount of thyroid hormone that you can actually produce. You also soak it up through your skin. So that's one of the reasons that it's so important to have a good fluoride filtering like shower head. Mm-hmm. Just to make sure that you're not getting it through the skin as well.
Do you have one of those?
I do.
What do you recommend?
So I have a vitamin C shower head.
Is it the brand or
a vitamin C filter shower head? So I think it has like charcoal in it, vitamin C. I think it might even have copper in it too.
Okay.
And that helps just kind of pull a lot of those minerals out, and then there's a little filter inside of it that you replace like every 6 months.
Awesome. Yeah, I really, as soon as I get out of this Airbnb, I would like to get one. Luckily, I've been in Jersey, so they don't have fluoride in the water there.
Oh, that's sick.
Yeah, I'm sure the water's not perfect otherwise, but getting fluoride is very reactive, very absorbent. It's really important to get a fluoride-free toothpaste. If you are worried about dental health, getting enough of the K2, calcium, very important. And then hydroxyapatite is something I've been looking into a little bit recently. I've been messing around with toothpaste. I'm not going to endorse this because I'm not well versed on it, and anything of these that's new can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to tell you to have this and then 10 years from now, hydroxyapatite is cancerous. But it's relatively safe. It's been shown to be very safe, and we do produce naturally. So it's the natural, I don't want to say buffer, but basically the natural protein that your body produces to, let's say, calcify your teeth. So teeth is one of the places that you want calcium. Mm-hmm. So it actually helps to increase the amount of calcium in your teeth.
Hmm. Interesting. I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Next would be boron.
Boron. There's nothing boring about boron.
Nothing at all.
So I wrote an article about this a while ago, and I think I literally stole the title from this NCBI article on PubMed. Boron is extremely cool. It's very underrated. Most people will not have heard about it, but it's number 5, right, in the periodic table.
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
I think it's 5. It's right after copper, I believe, and it's extremely important to steroidogenesis. So the main function it's being used for, or what it's being popularized for right now, is increasing free testosterone, mm-hmm. and decreasing SHBG, which magnesium mm-hmm. also does.
Which SHBG also attaches to estrogen. So there are some studies that show that it'll increase free estrogen as well. Okay. So that is something to take into consideration, but free T is also being freed up. So there's kind of like a yin-yang to it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And boron is one of those things that we used to pretty readily get in our soil. But because of soil depletion, monocrop agriculture, just things like that, it's much harder to get. So supplementing with boron is something that you may want to consider, especially mm-hmm. if you're boron deficient. Again, those micronutrient tests are great. Shout out Georgie Dinkov and Idea Labs. They have a toenail test that is supposed to be really accurate, which is and pretty cheap. So I would highly recommend going to those. But there's also like Reset Yourself. What else?
I've used
SpectraCell.
SpectraCell, yeah. That's the one that I used. It was a blood lab, and it was really good. It was really comprehensive. I liked it.
Yeah, so getting a nutrient test is probably going to be very important for establishing a baseline and see what you need to do, see if you're toxic in anything and all that stuff. And then you want to just talk about, is there anything we missed as far as minerals you want to get in?
Well, whenever it comes to boron, it's going to be densest in like the skin of fruits. So raisins are going to be a really good source of that. Typically, the dried fruits are going to be easier to get like a higher amount of skin mm-hmm. in. So that... Apples are another good one, but typically it's found in the skin of the fruit.
I swear we were talking about something last week that we were surprised boron was found in. I can't exactly remember.
I'm not really sure. I do know like it came to Earth by an asteroid, apparently.
Really?
Yeah, so apparently it's like an outer space mineral, which is kind of weird that it plays such an important biological role whenever mm-hmm. it's from outer space.
I was talking about deuterium. Which is like, basically it's like a type of water where the hydrogen has an extra neutron. I forget, it's an isotope. It's not radioactive. I think that's the right word, isotope, but basically has an extra hydrogen. They said that all of deuterium came from space, from an asteroid as well. Hmm. And it slows the mitochondria allegedly. It's interesting stuff, but not something we really need to worry about, in my opinion. It's more of a biohacker, get that extra very, for a good chunk of money, you can get an extra 5.5% performance mm-hmm. and maybe you can live a couple months longer.
Yeah.
But not something I don't think we really need to worry about.
Yeah.
So we got selenium, copper. Iron is very important, but a lot of us get too much of it because it's literally in every food. And it's balanced by copper, as we talked about.
Yeah, iron's probably been stored in your body since you were born, especially if you've been eating any food that's been fortified with iron. I mean, it's basically, like, literally, it's basically just iron chunks in your food. Like, it's nuts.
It's iron filings, literally. And same thing with fluoride. Fluoride is, like, it's naturally found, it's a natural element. But most of fluoride is, like, detoxified waste products from mm-hmm. manufacturing. So it's, like, manufactured runoff, which is crazy. And so avoiding those two things, I mean, not that you need to avoid iron, but it's in very small amounts. You need about 1 milligram a day because you absorb about 10%. So you need to consume about 10 milligrams a day to get 1 milligram a day. If your iron recycling system is working, which you need copper and vitamin A to do, another story, but it's in grains, it's in meat, it's in small amounts in fruits, it's in potatoes. Everything has some quality of iron. Some and vegetables have ferric iron, which is not as bioavailable. doesn't really matter because we all have too much of it. So 99% of us are going to be iron overloaded there. If you're anemic, of the people that are anemic, probably 1%, if that, I'd probably say 1% of 1% are actually iron deficient. And there's also, I mean, iron deficiency anemia gets all the spotlight, but if you look at the types of anemia, there's, I think, B12 deficiency anemia, there's B9, B6, because they're all necessary to make hemoglobin. Mm-hmm. And you could probably be deficient in, even magnesium could probably cause anemia.
Yeah. Like, if you have a suspicion that you're anemic, I would say just increase the amount of oysters that you're eating on a weekly basis from, like, if you're eating them once a week, bump them up to two, maybe bump them up to three times a week. And that's going to be very beneficial. They have B12, they have copper, they have zinc, and mm-hmm. they also have some iron in there as well.
And consuming them, I'm a big fan of consuming oyster and liver with coffee or milk because the calcium blocks the iron absorption. And again, I think we're all iron overloaded. If you think you're iron deficient, then don't do that. Mm-hmm. But you're probably not iron deficient.
Yeah, if you have a zinc deficiency and you're trying to eat those for zinc specifically, I wouldn't have them with the calcium because they compete for absorption, calcium okay. and zinc.
I wonder if coffee does that as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's interesting because coffee almost acts like a chelator in some cases.
So. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So yeah, as far as things, so what were we saying?
Also, like activated charcoal, if you're going to eat something that has iron in it or a heavy metal like mercury, for example. So if you're going to go eat a bunch of sushi or something like that, making sure that you supplement with either have some coffee after the meal or supplement with a little bit of activated charcoal before. Probably some vitamin E for the PUFA content too is going to be beneficial.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what sake is, but some wines or wine has tannins or grapes. So that helps to block iron absorption as well. I would assume that because mercury and iron have the same charge, that it might also work for mercury. But it also, which is interesting, I also haven't looked into and need to think about how it interacts with copper too. So if it's also blocking copper absorption, that could just be mitigating a lot of the benefits. Mm-hmm. So it's something to think about for sure.
Yeah, definitely. That's really all I can think about right now for minerals. Is there anything else you wanted to touch base on?
I just think it's very important to mitigate. So let's talk about minerals real quick that you don't want to get. Mm-hmm. So cadmium, iron, fluoride, aluminum in excess. Am I missing anything? Lead.
Lead, definitely. Yeah, we have a big problem with lead in our water here in Denver. So,
do we?
Yeah, so making sure that if you are in the Denver area, make sure to filter your water so you don't get too much lead.
Thank God I have that little water filter.
Yeah.
So I just got an Ozeri pan. There's also Extrema cookware, so there's like toxin-free. I know someone recommended, Josh Rubin recommended the Extrema, but Ozeri is like a fraction of the price and I love it so far. It's a great size. It heats up really fast. It's awesome. It cleans really easily. Maybe it's not perfect like the Extrema, but the Extrema apparently also very fragile. I'm not sponsored or anything by this. I really am happy with purchase. It was like a fraction of the cost and it's great pan. Don't see need for anything else.
Yeah. So that's one reason that I stopped using a cast iron pan is mm-hmm. because like you're basically just, cooking your food in an iron It literally in an iron pan, and so you're just adding extra iron that's unnecessary to take in through that.
Water bottles. If you're going to go with a water bottle, I like Purist. Again, not sponsored, but so what they do is they have a stainless steel bottle, and they seal it with this melted glass, which is really interesting, which is basically like drinking out of a glass vase. Glass is made of pure carbon, so it's one of the most stable and, let's say, non-interactive compounds there is. And it tastes good. You got to make sure you clean it still. You don't want any mold or anything, bring it up. It's very important to clean that stuff regularly. A lot of the stainless steel bottles, if it's magnetic, I think it's not good, right? According to Ray.
It also, like for those of you who have an induction stove, just make sure that if it is magnetic, that it's not actually like touching your food. Like there's a ceramic coating over the top or something like that. And the heat is just conducted through the bottom of the pan.
Interesting. Yeah. So apparently I believe the magnetic steel is just less stable, so it can leak cadmium into it. Yeah. It's just something that's very important to consider. And then obviously filtering your water, filtering your bath water if you can. Do you want to give a shout out to the brand you have for the shower filter again?
I don't remember the brand off the top.
So just look up for a reverse osmosis filter, if you can, is the best you can get.
You may not need that. A good like vitamin C filter shower head, typically like a 5-stage one, is it will usually do the job. Okay. Yeah.
And then there's a great water filter brand. Pristine Hydro is like the best you can get because it also remineralizes the water. So it's supposed to be basically like drinking very pure spring water without any of the detriments. But I'm trying to think of it. I recently found it.
Well, there's Berkey. So that's mm-hmm. usually the one that I'll just recommend off the top of my head, like as soon as someone asks. I have a Santivia gravity filter. It's a 5-stage gravity filter.
Is that what you have?
Yeah, that's the one that I have. It's not the best because it's plastic, but it's not really exposed to any heat, so there's not that much leaching. So it's not ideal, but it's a lot cheaper than the Berkey. I think it's like half the price of a Berkey, so it gets most of the bad stuff out.
Yeah, there's look up reverse osmosis countertop filter. I forget their brand, but it's like $300, and reverse osmosis is probably the highest quality you can get as far as a filtration device. So I think for $300, it's a great purchase. Mm-hmm. When I get my own apartment, I'll probably get that just because I have like an Aqualite Brita filter. Basically, it's like it's a pretty good it filters a lot of stuff, a lot of bacteria. They're actually getting rid of the fluoride filtering, so I'm not happy about that. But when I get my own apartment, I will have to step up my game a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. Sweet.
Awesome. Thank you for tuning in. Make sure to follow us on Instagram on Umzu Fit. You can find Jayden and I at Research Cowboy and at Ty Woodward Fit on Instagram and in the Thermo Diet group, Umzu community, and on Umzu Fit. So feel free to give us a shout out and ask us any questions.
Peace.